Haman works for the king of Syria. Syria is the enemy of Israel. They live to the north. I'll zoom out on our map so that we can see what things look like from there. That's a little far, but it'll work. Israel occupies this territory here. Syria is this large country up this direction. Damascus is right here. That's the capital of Syria. So Syria kind of goes back and forth throughout history as being a very powerful nation to being a defeated nation. And for years in our narrative, they have had conflicts with Israel. So at some times they're invading Israel, and at other times they're being defeated by Israel. It's been going back and forth for quite a while. So when we're here in this story and we run across Naaman, the Syrian, we have to understand that this is the top commander in the army of Israel's greatest enemy. But he's got a problem. He's leprous in one hand. And so that hand is becoming more and more useless as time goes on, and eventually the disease is going to claim Naaman's life because there's no cure for leprosy. Dan, I didn't even look. Do we have a cure for it now? I don't know either. Eldon?
I think we do.
Okay. Right. Okay. And it's not like remove the appendage, right? And that's how you cure gangrene, is cut it off. But that might be the way to cure leprosy. I mean, he probably could have done that, but you can imagine what losing the use of an arm would do to a military man. If you can't use your shield and your sword, you're pretty much useless as a soldier. So he has this big problem with this leprosy. He's high in favor with the king of Syria. He's a mighty man of valor, verse 1, but he was a leper. Verse 2, now the Syrians, we're in 2 Kings chapter 5, by the way. I guess I forgot to say that. 2 Kings chapter 5. Turns out Naaman has one other asset, and that is that on one of his incursions into Israel, the Syrians happened to capture a little Israelite girl. They brought her back to Damascus, or wherever Naaman is living in Syria, probably Damascus, and she becomes a slave, a servant girl, in Naaman's house. So as his leprosy is progressing, at one point, verse 3, this little girl says to her mistress, that would be Naaman's wife, would that my lord were with the prophet who is in Samaria. He would cure him of his leprosy. So this little girl knows about Elisha. She's heard of his power to do miracles. We have been looking at Elisha's miracles all throughout chapter 4. We're going to see another one in chapter 6. And so she tells her mistress that Elisha, who serves the God of Israel, would be able to heal Naaman. No problem. Mrs. Naaman tells her husband that there's hope for him in the country of Israel. Not too hard for us to understand how that goes. If somebody's racked with a bad disease and the doctor says, well, the only person I know that can help you is in wherever, we try to make every effort to get there to try and be healed of our ailment. So does Naaman. So the king of Syria goes to his boss. I'm sorry. Naaman goes to his boss, the king of Syria, and tells him the scenario. And the king of Syria gives him a little bit of medical leave, tells him, you go ahead, travel to Israel, I'll send a letter with you of recommendation to the king of Israel. And so he went, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. So how much weight is a talent?
A couple thousand pounds.
A talent? No, it's not a couple thousand pounds.
50 pounds?
Closer? About 75 pounds. So what's 75 pounds of silver times 10? 750 pounds of silver. What's silver worth these days? Somewhere around $16, $17 an ounce. I think last time we got into calculations, it was in the 20s, so it's really kind of dipped down here recently. But how many ounces in a pound? Ethan, you have our calculator fired up back there? Okay, so 16 ounces per pound times 750. That'll give us the number of ounces of silver that Naaman's traveling with, times about $17 a pound. How much money are we talking about? Okay, so he's got about $200,000 in silver. This is why we invented check cards and Visa cards, right? It's much easier to travel these days. You can put all your money in your little wallet. Well, Naaman doesn't have that option. He's got to carry the money with him. He probably is going with an entourage of soldiers to guard this much money as well. But verse 6, he brought the letter to the king of Israel. And again, as we talked about this last week, we're still sort of recapping last week. We talked about this last week. This makes sense because normally speaking, the religion of a country was controlled by the king of the country, and so the king of Syria expects the king of Israel to know which of his prophets would be able to accomplish this matter, because he expects that all of the prophets and priests would be in the employ of the king. And so he sends Naaman to the king of Israel and brings him this present and says, verse 6, when this letter reaches you, know that I have sent to you Naaman, my servant, that you may cure him of his leprosy. But how does the king of Israel take this message? How does he respond to it? Great, what an opportunity to befriend our enemies to the north, right? This could work out really well. Bring out my best physician. He tears his clothes. Now, why does he tear his clothes? Either anger or sad. Which one do you think this one is?
Anger.
Maybe a little both, right? Okay. And his answer there in verse 7, when the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes and said, "Am I God to kill and make alive, that this man sends word to me to cure a man of his leprosy?" Again, remembering this disease is incurable. Even today we have a hard time with it. But so he responds the way we would if I just walked up and said, if I were the king of a neighboring country, I guess, and said, "Matt, I need you to heal the cancer of my daughter here. And, you know, if not, we're probably going to go to war. Me and you going to have it out, okay?" Then Matt would probably say, "Give it your best shot, Buster." Right? What's that?
I'd say that
sounds good, but not bad. That's right. the king of Israel thinks that the king of Syria is trying to provoke a conflict. Well, I don't know that this is really reasonable thinking, because has the king of Syria needed an excuse before? They've just fought. They've just invaded each other. So I'm not sure why the king of Israel goes this direction, but this is what he's thinking, that Syria is trying to provoke a conflict. Somehow, in verse 8, when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes. So Elisha, who lives in Samaria at this point, so probably has a house there. There might even be a school of the prophets in Samaria where he stays. Somehow he hears that the king of Israel has torn his clothes and is in deep lament over this issue. And so when he hears about it, he sends to the king one of his messengers and says, "Why have you torn your clothes? Let him come now to me that he may know that there is a prophet in Israel." This is a subtle rebuke to the king of Israel. And it's not very subtle, I guess. This is probably a pretty open rebuke. Say, why didn't you send him to me? You don't acknowledge me as a prophet? You don't think there's a God in Israel that can take care of this? I know you don't, or you would have sent him to me. So Elisha has to tell the king, "You send him my direction, and I'll prove to you that God is able to take care of this." So, verse 9, "So Naaman came with his horses and his chariots and stood at the door of Elisha's house." Now I'm going to read through this scenario. Think through it. Think about how this sounds to you as far as a Well, I'll just read it and tell me what you think, okay? So Naaman came with his horses and chariots and stood at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored, and you shall be clean." So, how would you respond to this? You're Naaman the Syrian, you're chief of the commander of the armies of Syria. You go to the prophet's house, his servant comes out and says, "Yeah, go take a bath. 7 times. Go wash in the Jordan River and you'll be clean." And then the servant departs. Now, what do you think of this? Is he nuts? Why would you think he's nuts? Oh, because people can't normally cure leprosy. Yeah. So you'd think he's crazy for suggesting that a bath will cure it. Yeah. Okay? What else about this interchange sounds interesting? Elisha doesn't even come out of the house to meet him. Now, how would you perceive this if you're the commander of the army of Syria? Very rude. Yeah, this would be considered a huge insult. Elisha doesn't even come out of the house. He sends his servant outside and gives him these orders and dismisses him. Why do you think Elisha does that? To humble Naaman. Why does Naaman need to be humbled? Okay, so maybe being elevated in the ranks of Syria has gone to Naaman's head, and he thinks he really is kind of all that, right? Okay. Something repeated throughout Scripture several times, God is no respecter of persons, right? And it definitely is to humble Naaman and see if he will obey the word by faith. Because Elisha's not even going to come out and make a big deal of this. Now, Naaman would have been used to people coming out and making a big deal of his arrival, probably inviting him to stay for a while, at least have dinner. So what Elisha's doing here is culturally considered extremely rude behavior. Because if somebody stops by your house, obviously you should invite them in, let them wash their feet, rest from their long journey, eat some dinner, probably spend the night, especially if he's a high official. You'd give him the best bed, the best food, but Elisha doesn't do any of that. He simply sends him on his way. And so it is a very culturally rude statement, but Elisha is doing it on purpose, I think, for exactly what Ethan said. He's humbling Naaman to see if he will humbly and with faith obey the word God gives him. And so that word is, go wash in the Jordan River 7 times. Now, how does Naaman respond to this? Let's go to verse 11. Naaman was angry and he went away saying, "Behold, I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call upon the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. Are not Abana and Pharphar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?" So he turned and went away in a rage. What is Naaman's contention here? He's got a couple of them. What are his major points of contention? All right, he didn't come out to meet me. That's one of them. He didn't come out to meet me. What else didn't Elisha do that Naaman was expecting? He didn't make it showy. Ooh, this is huge, right? Why would Naaman expect a big showy thing? Because why? Partly because he's a high official. Okay, I don't think it's actually because he knows God's powerful. Not yet. Like the Pharisees giving money to people? Yeah, like the Pharisees giving money to people. The religion of the day, and I guess it's not all that different from our day, was very, very showy and flashy. If the priests were going to do anything, and not just the priests in Israel, but if the priests of the nations around Israel were going to do anything, it was with great pomp and ceremony. Especially if they were going to pretend to do a miracle. You know, we have some accounts of the exorcists in the first century. And so I realize we're removed from this event a little bit, but it sort of displays how the ancient world looked at these things. That Jewish exorcists would travel around and earn their living by casting out demons. And one of the things they liked to do was put a bucket full of water on the floor over by the door, so that when they cast the demon out, it would knock over the bucket of water. Right? Showy. Flashy. We want to have some pomp here going into this. You ever watch magicians on TV do their little tricks? They don't just do the trick, do they? There's always music and flashing lights, and then, we know part of that is to trick your mind, to distract you from what's actually going on, because if it were quiet and everything were still, we'd be able to see the person sneaking out of the box and crawling around to the other side or whatever it is. But you don't, because it's got to be big and flashy, number one, to trick your eyes, but number two, to make it seem more like, wow, that was really spectacular. So Naaman is disappointed that Elisha's not giving him some spectacular show, because he thinks, well, all the miracle workers in my religion would give me a big show, and then I'd be happy. Okay, well, so what's his third contention? Number one, he wasn't treated like a royal official. Number two, he wasn't given a big pompous show. And what's number three? Daniel.
He has to wash in the dirtiest river.
He's got to wash in the dirtiest river known, right? Okay, the Jordan River is not a pretty clean, pristine, clear river. It's always muddy. I don't know why, it just is, but it's always muddy. The rivers that flow through Syria are almost always very clear, nice, cool, crisp water. And so he looks in disdain at God's land, at God's chosen land, and says, oh, come on, there's nothing spectacular about the Jordan River. So what's Naaman supposed to learn here? Eldon.
Obedience,
even when it doesn't make sense, right? Does the healing have anything to do with Elisha? I mean, really? Not really. Elisha's not going to perform the miracle because he doesn't want to reinforce in Naaman's mind that it's about the prophet. And so he doesn't give him a big showy thing so that Naaman can't walk away with any inkling of thinking, Elisha healed me. Because Elisha's not even going to come out and see him. Naaman is expecting a big pompous show, and he's not going to get it, because Elisha is trying to instruct Naaman with this fact that it's not about ceremony. It's not about what you're going to do. All he gives him is this simple little task, go wash in the Jordan River, because third thing, Elisha is trying to teach Naaman it has nothing to do with the river. It's not the water that's going to clean you. It's not the ceremony that's going to clean you. It's not the person that's going to clean you. Who's going to clean you? God is going to do this. If you faithfully do what he said. If you faithfully obey. And so, Naaman, at first, how does he respond to the test? What's he do at first? He huffs off. He says, this is ridiculous. I'm out of here. There's no power here. And but he walks away in a rage. So verse 13. But his servants came near and said to him, now you got to respect these guys. So you're in the employ of the highest official that works for the king of Syria. He's the commander of an army, so he's obviously no stranger to bloodshed. And he's in a fit of rage. Would you walk up to him and try to give him advice at this point? You got to respect these guys. They must have loved their master quite a bit, just like the servant girl did. So they walk up, and notice how they address him, though. This is, anybody ever read the book, How to Win Friends and Influence People? Yeah, it starts off in the beginning. Who was that? That was Rockefeller wrote that, right? No? It was Carnegie? But not Andrew Carnegie. It was Andrew Carnegie. Oh, Dale Carnegie. Okay. So he writes this book, Dale Carnegie, of course, big name in the steel industry. And he writes this book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And this is where we get the basic idea that you start off with compliments and then finish with criticisms, right? To try and win people over and let them listen to you a little better. So Andrew Carnegie didn't come up with it. It's been known for a very long time. But he published the book, and so he gets credit. But this is what the servants are going to do. My father, and obviously that is not an unusual way for servants to respond to their masters. Because as the head of the household, he was like a father to everybody and responsible for providing for them. And so they acknowledge that. My father, it is a great word the prophet has spoken to you. Will you not do it? He has actually said to you, wash, or has he actually said to you, wash and be clean? So their advice here is, this is fantastic. He just told you to go do a very simple little thing. Aren't you going to do it? So if you're struggling, how many of you, anybody allergic to poison ivy? Hannah? Eldon? I mean, like, really allergic? You really get it badly, Eldon? Okay. See, Hannah and I, we get it if we're downwind of the stuff. It's bad, right? But one time I went weed eating with some friends of mine. We were raising some money for a youth trip. And didn't realize I was weed whacking poison ivy. And so came out of that just covered head to toe blisters. And went on for 2 weeks before, guess what the doctor prescribed? You probably know the cure for poison ivy. Prednisone, right? So he puts me on prednisone for 2 weeks and cures it up. So if I had said, that's ridiculous, that sounds too easy, no way am I going to do that. Take these dumb little pills. That's all you want me to do? I expected you to give me something hard, like scrub my skin with a brick every day for 3 weeks. Drink, what is that stuff? Castor oil to soften the skin and everything. No, this is too easy. I'm just going to take prednisone. And so his servants are saying to him, you're not going to do this because it's too easy? You're not going to do this because it's not flashy enough? You're not going to do this because he asked you to wash in a muddy river? I mean, the guy says you'll be healed. Give it a shot, at least. And so he decides to. And he says, you know what? You're right. I think I'm being a little silly about this. Verse 14, so he went down and dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. I mean, what an amazing moment for Naaman to learn this lesson. You obey God by faith. Now, it's not the works that saved him, but here's that interaction that the New Testament challenges us with. Paul very clearly tells us it is not our works that save us. You know, doing things like helping out the poor and going to church and giving money and offerings and sitting and listening to pastor's sermon, those things earn you 0 credit with God as far as your sins are concerned, right? Absolutely nothing, because our salvation is based on Christ's merit and His merit only. Nothing that I do. But if I really believe that, that will result in me being obedient to Him. Because if I believe that He's Lord and died for me, then I'm going to submit myself to His rulership over me. Does my submission to Him save me? Not in the slightest. God counts faith towards righteousness, not works. Naaman's learning that. So he believed the word that Elisha spoke. And notice what Elisha's called here. He's no longer called a prophet. He's called a man of God. Why? Because the writer of this history is acknowledging for us that what Elisha spoke was God's word. And so if Naaman walked away without believing it, then he couldn't be delivered from his leprosy. Because God wants us to believe Him when He speaks. So he goes down, he washes in the Jordan 7 times. He's believing that what Elisha said would happen will happen. And when he gets out of the water, he looks like a little child. I've never ceased to be amazed at the fact that when a baby's born, their skin is just so perfect and soft. Yeah, it's amazing stuff. But I mean, think about it. They've been soaking in salt water for 9 months. I mean, how would our skin look if we just sat in a bath? Well, we'd be all pruny, right? But their skin it's flawless when they come out. Of course, then a couple of days later, you know, you have all the, well, I won't get into it. It's kind of gross, but it's like a little child and he was clean. So verse 15, he does what any of us would be expected to do. He returns to the man of God, he and all his company, and he came and stood before him, and he said, behold, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. Now that is a fantastic statement to make, isn't it? Naaman has connected the dots. Because Who else was able to heal him? Nobody. And you can be sure that Naaman went through whatever religious ceremonies the priests of Syria told him to go through. You can be sure he has already offered all the sacrifices to all the gods of Syria. And which of them have helped him? None of them. But he comes to Israel, he gets this simple command from the God of Israel, he does it, and now he's clean. And that confirms everything for him. So he comes up to Elisha and says, I get it. This healing, this wasn't about me becoming clean. This was about me recognizing there is no God in all the earth but the God of Israel. That's a very powerful statement he makes. So now, accept a present from your servant. This was a typical response as well. People still treat pastors this way today. You know, you preach at funerals and they want to pay you. They call it an honorarium. And you know, the scriptures tell us that he that lives by the gospel should live, or he that preaches the gospel should live by the gospel. So there's nothing wrong with pastors and preachings being paid for what they do and being supported for it. But at the same time, it's a little awkward when you just preach someone's funeral and then they want to hand you a check. It's like, I didn't do it for that reason. I don't really want this. You know, especially not right now. If you want to give something, do it later, because I don't want it to look like I'm involved in this for the sake of the money. But guess what? Some people are. Some people are. And throughout even the history of the world, even the Old Testament times, the priests of all of the religions around Israel, oh boy, they loved presents because it made them extremely wealthy. Because if you feel like you exercise some degree of control over the eternal destiny of people, you can get rich doing it. And that's what they did. So all of the other priests probably had taken some kind of payment from Naaman, even though they had never healed him. And so he figures that Elisha also is going to want some kind of remuneration or honorarium for what he's doing here. And so he brings, except now, a present. But Elisha says, as the Lord lives, and he swears this oath, before whom I stand, I will receive none. Now, how do you think Elisha earned his living? God's providence. I mean, he's a prophet. He travels around Israel preaching and teaching. How does he make his money? People help him out, all right? Like the widow of Shunem, or not the widow of Shunem, the Shunammite woman who built the room on top of the house. And every time he was passing by there, she provided him with room and board. So what would be wrong with him taking the money? The reason behind Naaman giving it, right. Yeah, so Elisha, recognizing he's got kind of a new believer here, doesn't want to instill in Naaman the sense that the word of God is preached for the sake of finances. And so he says, nope, I won't take any. I won't take any money. I'm not going to be paid for services rendered. And that's not why pastors do what they do. You know, we don't look at, we call it this because it's kind of easy terminology, but it's not really a paycheck for services rendered, right? You guys support me so that I can do the ministry. If it ever came about that support wasn't available, guess what? I'd still seek to do as much ministry as I possibly could because it's what God called me to do. But the blessing is that you guys share with us. I'm able to support myself and my family on it, but it's not like you're paying me in exchange for the teaching. I don't know if this is coming out clearly or not, but it's, I look at it more like you guys support me so that I can do what God's called me to do. Okay. Well, Elisha's going to give that same distinction here. As the Lord lives, before whom I stand, I will receive none. And he urged him to take it, but he refused. You ever get into one of those situations and someone's saying, here, take this. And you say, no, it's okay. No, take it. I want you to take it. No, it's okay. It's awkward, isn't it? Who's going to give in first? Because you don't want to appear rude for not receiving a gift, but at the same time, if you really don't want to take it, you almost just have to, no, I don't want it. So, But he says he won't take it. Then, verse 17, then Naaman said, if not, please let there be given to your servant 2 mule loads of earth, for from now on your servant will not offer burnt offering or sacrifice to any god but the Lord. What is this all about? Naaman wants to take home 2 mule loads of dirt from Israel. Why? What's dirt got to do with it? And you'll have to think back a little bit to why the Syrians got beat a few chapters ago. They thought God was confined to a certain region, right? Naaman's carrying some of this bad theology with him yet. We can understand this. He's a very new believer. But he still has got this idea that God can only be worshipped in the land that he occupies. And so he says, I want to take some of Israel's dirt back home with me. And I'm going to pour it on the ground and I'm going to build an altar there so that I can worship God on his own land. What's the problem with that thinking? What's that? God can be worshipped anywhere, right? Because he made everything, right? Is there any piece of dirt, any speck of dust in the cosmos that doesn't belong to him? It's all his. Verse 18, in this matter may the Lord pardon your servant. When my master goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there, leaning on my arm, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, when I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon your servant in this matter. So he recognizes that this thing he wants to do here is not exactly what God would want. Because what he says is, when I go back to serve my king, there are going to be times that I have to accompany him into the temple of his god Rimmon and worship with him. And so he's kind of asking Elisha for permission to participate in idolatry. And what's Elisha's response?
No.
Does he say that? Look at verse 19.
Go in peace.
Go in peace. Now, is that permission? Kind of, sort of, maybe not really. He says go in peace. So he's not going to burden the guy with a prohibition. But he doesn't really give him permission either. He just simply bids him farewell. But what Naaman wants to do here is continue to worship the Lord, but still maintain his position as chief of the army. Because you can be sure that if he went home and said to his king, I'm sorry, I'm only worshiping the god of your enemy Israel now. I can't go into the house of Rimmon and worship with you. What would happen? Get fired? That'd probably be the least of his worries. He'd probably be executed. So we can understand where Naaman's coming from. We can also understand how Elisha doesn't burden him down with this. But it leaves us with a little bit of mystery, doesn't it? Has God told us what he thinks of idolatry? Has he told us what we should do in those circumstances? Sure he has. Don't make any graven images. Don't bow down to them. But Naaman departs. We got 10 minutes here. We'll keep going. When Naaman had gone from him a short distance, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, see, my master has spared this Naaman the Syrian in not accepting from his hand what he brought. As the Lord lives, I will run after him and get something from him. So here's Gehazi. He saw an opportunity to get an awful lot of money. And he sees Elisha not taking it, and he says, ooh, I got to make something of this situation. I think I can rectify this. And you notice the wording he used there? He has spared Naaman the Syrian. Why do you think he uses that wording? The disease could have killed him, but he says spared him in not accepting a gift from him. Was that a hand, Matt? Oh, okay, sorry. Why might Gehazi see this as sparing Naaman?
Because
by not accepting the gift. Number one, it's a lot of money, and Gehazi wants some of it. Number two, where is Naaman from? Syria, not Assyria, Syria. And how do Israel and Syria get along? Not very well. So I think Gehazi here has got a little bit of nationalistic pride going on and saying, well, this guy's from our enemy. And you didn't even take any money from him. You could have at least charged him a toll for passing through the land. Let's remove him of some of that weight so it's easier for him to travel home, right? I mean, 750 pounds of silver. That's a lot of weight to carry around. We should help him out, lighten his load. So, Gehazi, verse 21, Gehazi followed Naaman. And when Naaman saw someone returning after him, he got down from the chariot to meet him and said, "Is all well?" That's pretty typical greeting. Hey, what's going on? How come you're chasing me now? I just left you a little bit ago and everything was good. Did something come up? And so, verse 22, Gehazi said, "All is well. My master sent me to say, there have just now come two young men from the hill country of Ephraim, of the sons of the prophets. Please give them a talent of silver and two changes of clothing." So what's Gehazi doing here?
Lying.
Or as we like to say, to emphasize that a little more, he's lying through his teeth. I don't know what the difference is, because pretty much every time you speak, it's coming through your teeth. But he's lying through his teeth. And he's playing on Naaman's sympathies. Hey, you know, this isn't for Elisha. He didn't change his mind. But he's hoping you'll help out these two less fortunate sons of the prophets, these other ministers that have come in. They could use some help. So they don't even want much, just a talent of silver and a couple of changes of clothes. Now, to us, the changes of clothes don't sound like much. We can go to Walmart, buy a change of clothes for $10 or $15. But you got to understand how difficult clothing was to make, because what fabric are most of our clothes made out of? Cotton. What material did the ancient Eastern peoples not have access to because it wasn't discovered until we found America?
Cotton.
So where do they get all their clothes? Wool or linen or silk. They did have silk from the Orient. So you had a much more narrower brand of clothing that you could work with. So you're either working with wool or linen or silk. And we don't have, you don't have cotton mills to separate the seeds. You don't have mills to process the wool into yarn. You have to do that all by hand. Clothing was extremely expensive. Think back to the very beginning of our study. Way back to 1 Samuel. In the early chapters, how often did Hannah bring Samuel a change of clothes? Every year. You got one change of clothes every year. You know why? Because clothing was hard to come by. I don't know about you guys, but our kids seem to be ingenious at putting holes in the knees of pants. I don't know why that is. They are just masters of the trade. If there is a staple or nail or a sharpish piece of metal somewhere, they can rub up against it and tear a hole in their clothes. And then you say, you know what? We don't patch them much anymore. Did you guys patch clothes when your kids were younger? My mom used to patch our clothes. Occasionally she'd patch up jeans. But you know what? You don't even patch clothes anymore. You just toss them and get another pair because they're so inexpensive. But getting two changes of clothing was a pretty big deal. I'm going off on that for too long of a time. But he wants a talent of silver, two changes of clothing. So he's not even asking for all that much. I mean, these are expensive things. But compared to how much money Naaman brought with him, it's a very small matter. So Naaman, in his generosity, says, "Be pleased to accept two talents." And Gehazi, I love this part, he urged him and tied up two talents of silver in two bags. So you can imagine how hard did Naaman have to urge Gehazi to take two talents of silver instead of one. I can imagine Gehazi standing there saying, no, I can't. It's okay. No, I shouldn't. Okay, since you're twisting my arm, I'll take two talents of silver. So he urged him, and he takes it. And he put the silver in two bags with two changes of clothing, laid them on two of his servants, and they carried them before Gehazi. So now Gehazi not only gets to return with all of this money and these changes of clothing, but he's got two servants carrying it for him. He doesn't even have to struggle with it. So they carried them before Gehazi, verse 24. And when he came to the hill, he took them from their hand, put them in the house, sent the men away, and they departed. And he thinks everything is good. He went in, stood before his master Elisha, and is going to pretend like, oh, everything's good. And so what's Elisha's question for him? Well, he doesn't quite say that just yet. What does he say first? Where have you been? Now, we've asked this many times before. What do you do when you encounter a question from God? I understand this is Elisha, but he's speaking as God's mouthpiece. So, what do you do when you encounter a question from God? Is God looking for information?
No.
So, what's this question designed to do?
Make you sweat.
That's right. It's designed to make Gehazi sweat just a little bit. Where have you been? But it's also an opportunity for him to confess and repent. Does he? What does he tell him? Your servant went nowhere. You guys probably have had the same experience we've had, but how many times in your lives did nobody really mess something up? Or, I don't know, is a close cousin. Not me is another one. Yep, that's his brother. It's either not me, I don't know, or no one. And we'll say, who did this? And all the kids answer, not me, I don't know. Yeah. Or they just stand there and look at you like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And you say, it must be nobody. It's amazing. Who made this huge, who spread the crayons all over the floor? And you say, there's got to be an answer somewhere. Your servant went nowhere. I didn't do anything. But he said to him, did not my heart go when the man turned from his chariot to meet you? In other words, I saw the whole thing. Because as the Spirit of God was working through me, I'm able to see, God, let me see exactly what you were doing, Gehazi. And you just blew an opportunity to confess this of your own free will and turn away from it. Was it a time to accept money and garments, olive orchards and vineyards, sheep and oxen, male servants and female servants? Now Gehazi here might be able to say, whoa, 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 whoa. What are you talking about vineyards and olive gardens? Male, so I didn't take anything like that, did he? I think Elisha's giving us a little clue as to what Gehazi wanted to accomplish with this money. Ooh, now I have enough money to buy something, right? Verse 27, the judgment comes. Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and to your descendants forever. We talked about this morning, dads. Do the decisions we make as fathers impact generations to come? Yes, they do. In one sense, every man stands on his own before God. Relationship with God is completely dependent upon your decision to believe Him or not believe Him, but there are consequences of our decisions that flow through life. How many people have been affected by Adam's decision? Billions. How many people will be affected by our decisions? How many people are going to be affected by Gehazi's decision? And somehow God ensures that Naaman's leprosy sticks to Gehazi, so he went out from his presence a leper like snow. So, what's our kingly lesson? Don't lie to a prophet? Yeah. Eldon. Perfect. Don't be deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that shall he reap. There is no such thing as getting away with anything. We never make decisions that don't come with consequences. So make the right ones. Study God's word. Find out what he says is right and what he says is wrong, and faithfully do it. If you find out you've done wrong, don't worry, he forgives abundantly. Your relationship with him is based on Christ's merit, not your own. But there are consequences that follow throughout life because of our decisions. Any questions?